The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network. www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. We have the author of Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit, Dane Hucklebridge. He's here. Dane, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
This book, Bourbon, I mean, you know, it's kind of the history, well, it says it's the history of the American spirit. We go way back, even before this country was founded with this book, don't we?
Yes, we certainly do. And that was, I think, a unique approach I wanted to take is oftentimes when you read about bourbon whiskey, you know, unanimously it starts in Kentucky in the late 1700s, early 1800s, which makes sense. It's certainly a good place to begin and obviously crucial. But for me, I was thinking about it and I thought starting there was a little bit like starting American history in 1776. You know, it's obviously very important, but you don't understand that importance unless you take a look at what came before it. So in this book, which I think is maybe a little different, we go way back and, you know, this premise that bourbon is the American spirit, what makes it parallel America so well in a way is that you have something from the old world, which is distilling techniques, meeting something from the new world, which is this indigenous grain corn that had been cultivated for thousands of years, coming together in this new land, the new frontier, and evolving into something new and original that the world hadn't seen before, which I thought was a pretty good analogy for America. So yeah, it begins, you know, on those two sides. It begins talking a little bit about how distilling came to be in medieval Europe, taking beers and wines and running them through a still to collect the vapor and recondense it into stronger alcohol. It talks about the importance of corn in Native American societies and how actually there was corn beer consumed in you know, a number of these different societies in the Americas. And then so you have these two sides, and then really you start to see pretty early on, and I begin the first instance I could find of European colonists making alcohol out of corn, which is the precursor to modern bourbon, is in Jamestown, you know, in Virginia in the early 1600s. And that's, you know, it was surprising, but it's also fascinating because right when our own national story, right when our own country was sort of taking its first wobbly steps in this new world, you know, the origins of bourbon were right there too.
If you think this history of the American spirit, your book Bourbon, is going to be just pretty much a dry walk through history, it's not. You add some comedy in here also.
Yeah, I was a history major in college, and I remembered how tough history could be, often in the classroom, when it seemed overly dry and a little bit drab and memorizing dates, when really I think history should be anything but that. I mean, history is the story of everything. It's all the characters and stories and adventures and, you know, great scandals. It's all of that, which is, you know, sort of the stuff of life. It's what makes things interesting. It just happened to have occurred in the past. So I tried to imbue the text, really insert that feeling in there and give it a little personality. And, you know, bourbon has quite a few interesting characters associated with it. And I really tried to capture that and make it, you know, it's fun to drink bourbon, so it should be fun to read about it too. That was my approach.
I would think bourbon, right from the hills of Kentucky, probably in little moonshine bottles at first, and that's where bourbon originated. But there is a lot of conflict on where bourbon really originated, isn't
there?
Sure.
Well, it's hard to stick an exact time and place on it, and also depends how you define bourbon. What we think of it, and for a whiskey, the crucial thing to remember, for a whiskey to be considered bourbon, it needs to be made primarily from corn, and it needs to be aged in a new charred oak barrel. So that's really those are really the two most important factors. And when that first started happening was probably in Kentucky in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And part of the reason it happened then, you know, the Kentucky, that frontier had just opened up after the Revolution. It had been off limits before. Settlers were coming in, but they found that the grain, they had been using a lot of rye before on the eastern seaboard to make whiskey. That didn't grow as well out here in the wilderness. But corn, this indigenous Native American grain that is American and that was cultivated, you know, bred to be cultivated in, you know, the wilder parts of the country, it flourished. And, you know, because corn did so well, they started, you know, the settlers started making whiskey out of it instead of the rye or other grains they had been before. So cut off on the other side of the mountains with lots of corn on their hands, it was a great way to take their excess corn because they had more than they needed. They didn't have anywhere to sell it. It was too hard to ship it across the mountains, but making it into whiskey was far more valuable. And what they also learned very quickly was, interestingly, it actually increased in value because when they were putting it in these barrels, sending it down the Ohio River, the Mississippi, down there to New Orleans and from there all over, it was actually getting better and better tasting. I mean, aging alcohol in these barrels, specifically charred barrels, made it taste better. So it was a great way to make a little extra money, and that's how the business really began.
Was it just an accident that they started charring the barrels?
Well, there's a couple theories on this, and they're both interesting. For charring barrels, one theory is that they used to recycle a lot of barrels back then. They were, you know, kind of hard to make and expensive. So, and, you know, if you had a barrel that had been used to store pickled pig's feet, the last thing you wanted to do is just dump out the pickled pig's feet when you've eaten them all and then fill it full of whiskey. And it'd be pretty unpleasant tasting whiskey, I think. So there's one theory is that that was a way so you could reuse the barrels, kind of burn out whatever flavor had been there before. The other theory I have read, and I think this one probably is more accurate, but there could be truth to both, is that it was just a technique for coopers in those days. When they finished a barrel, they were very raw on the outside, lots of sap bubbles and splinters and sawdust and whatnot. They're, you know, they weren't very clean or pleasant. And it was a way of sort of sterilizing them and getting rid of all those splinters and sap and things like that that was on the inside. And that's how it began. So there are two theories.
So the charcoal pretty much mellows what's in it.
Yeah, but that's sort of the happy accident of it. And bourbon has a lot of these happy accidents that, you know, charcoal makes a great filter. And when you've got the inside of the barrels charred, it's the whiskey is, you know, as it contracts and expands through the seasons, it's sort of sucking the whiskey up into the wood and then pushing it back out. And the charcoal's filtering it. And it's taking out a lot of the unpleasant, harsh chemicals. And if you ever had unaged liquor, you know, it's harsh. It doesn't have that mellowness. And that's because the charcoal was filtering out some of these unpleasant chemicals and compounds that were in it. And then in the process, also adding some of its own flavor, that the tannins and the rich smokiness, which gives bourbon its distinct flavor.
So could I take a whiskey, a cheap whiskey, take it home, pretty much put it in a barrel, let it sit for a while and make it better?
It would probably improve it. I mean, I think it would, although if you have a very poorly made whiskey to begin with that isn't pure, you know, oftentimes low quality whiskey you'll find is blended. And sometimes they'll add things that aren't actually alcohol, flavoring, caramel color, what have you. And if you took a whiskey like that and aged it, it would probably improve it. But I don't think it would ever be as good as the real pure stuff.
Dan, you talked about corn beer. I think there was a time where there might have been a Schaefer beer out there somewhere. Whether it's still there, I don't know. But it seems like that was made primarily with corn. I might be totally wrong, but doing the research on this book, did you ever come across corn beer, corn ale, and try it?
Corn ale, in the modern era, not so much. I know even today in Latin America, in parts of Mexico and South America, there's something called chicha beer, which is consumed and popular, and it's still, as it did back in, you know, back in ancient times, in many indigenous civilizations or societies, it still has sort of a ceremonial function. It's, you know, I've watched films of chicha ceremonies in the Amazon and things like that. So that's still around and still exists. As for in North America, you know, cracking open a Maize Light corn beer, I've never come across it, and I suppose probably why that never caught on. It's possible just because it doesn't taste especially good, but I would suspect it's because the grains from the old world that they needed here actually in the north grew well. Like barley in the northern parts in Germany grew well. It was more in the south, where relatively southern parts where whiskey really first took hold, corn whiskey, that barley didn't and rye didn't grow as well because of the climate. So I would say that's part of it.
Maybe I just had one too many beers at one time, maybe, and maybe I thought it was corn beer. I don't know. History of the American Spirit Bourbon. Dane, your brand new book. How did you come up with the idea to do the history for this fantastic spirit?
Well, it's a funny story. I love history. I specifically love American history, and I've always enjoyed really those entertaining, in-depth histories of America and its products. And I wanted to do something like that. And it's, you know, it was funny. I was hanging out with my agent and we were in the back and I was telling him about the, about some ideas I had for doing something like this. And frankly, they weren't very good. My ideas were pretty bad. And, you know, after talking about it, I was a little bummed out, a little crestfallen because, you know, I realized how bad these ideas were. And it turns out one thing we always did though, when we meet, we always drink bourbon in his backyard because we both like it. And, you know, the light bulb went off. It came to him. He said, well, heck, why don't we do a book about bourbon? We drink enough of the darn stuff and you like it. What about that? And I thought about it and I started looking into it. And initially it seemed like a good idea. You think of pioneers and cowboys and bootleggers and what have you. So it seemed like there was a good story there. But once I started reading more of the history, because I'd always just taken it for granted, bourbon whiskey was always around, but I didn't know that much about the history. It was fascinating how closely it paralleled American history. And it became clear relatively quickly that it wasn't just a byproduct of the American experience, that it really was the American experience. And you could tell our story in a unique and interesting way through this whiskey.
My guess is that just like any alcohol out there, there's a top shelf alcohol, then you have that stuff in the center, and then probably that bottom shelf is probably the worst stuff you can get. Talk to me about bourbon. What are good bourbons, and really what makes a bad bourbon? Or is there such a thing as
sure.
a bad bourbon?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it all has to do with preference. And that's one thing, you know, going through Kentucky and talking to people, you'll hear lots of opinions. And there's some whiskeys people generally agree on are better, but there's, you know, it's really up to you and what you like. You know, some people love just drinking Wild Turkey on the rock. Some people really savor the expensive stuff in snifters. It's really personal preference. That being said, though, There are certain bourbons that are regarded as top-notch. One you hear a lot about these days is Pappy Van Winkle, especially their Family Reserve 23-year, I think it is, which is so rare that it's very hard to find in a lot of stores. And even if you find it, it's going for $1,000, sometimes more than that, dollars. So that's, you know, that's very top-shelf stuff. That's the best of the best, and it's hard to get. That being said, there's a lot of good small-batch bourbons out there as well. And it's sort of a relatively recent phenomenon. They really, first in the 80s, but not really until the 90s, did we start to see these higher quality small batch bourbons. And though, you know, I love Knob Creek, I love Booker's, Blanton's, I think all those are very good. And on a more day-to-day basis, bourbons I'm happy to drink on the rocks or sometimes neat and enjoy are things like Buffalo Trace or Maker's Mark. I think those are, you know, can be pretty tasty as well. Probably the worst, you know, I don't want to say worst, but the whiskey that you want to be careful of isn't the... It would be blended whiskey in some instances because that's, as I mentioned before, that's the whiskey that often has coloring and flavor added to it. It's not pure, you know, the pure corn spirit aged in charred oak. So those, you know, straight bourbon is something to look for, even though not all those are necessarily top notch.
So when you take that bourbon and you treat it like a fine wine and you're getting all the flavors out of it, what does a bourbon really bring to the palate?
I think you're definitely going to get a little bit of the smokiness from the char. So, but not in the way, it doesn't taste to me the way Scotch does. You know, Scotch has that peaty smokiness. This is more of a wood smokiness. So a little bit of that, you'll get some sweetness and that'll come from the corn because, you know, corn naturally comes off very sweet. And also too, from the wood, there's some caramelized sugars, I believe, in the wood that you get a little taste of. You'll get some tannins that's again, that woody taste that, you know, real rich background to it. And sometimes, and I'll be the first to admit, I'm not the greatest bourbon connoisseur. I kind of like everything. So I'm not necessarily going to be the one sniffing it and offering a long commentary on it, but you can get real subtle aromas, just like wine tasting, you know, citrus, honeysuckle, almond, things like that as well.
To distill a beverage like this, like a whiskey, going through a copper kettle, more or less, you mentioned it started before even America was founded. Wasn't it pretty much invented by a young man who was writing awful stories? Some might call him even dirty, risque. Then he saw God or Jesus.
Yes. Well, this
become
is
become a monk, huh?
Yeah. This is an interesting, a very interesting tale of distilling's origins, making brandy, whiskey, you know, the hard liquor. So wine and beer have been around, you know, as long as agriculture has, essentially, because it just relies on wild yeast, you know, coming into your glass or bottle and gradually turning that fruit juice or, grain porridge into wine or beer. What happened, though, is there's a certain limit that alcohol can reach. At some point, the yeast, which produce alcohol as a waste product from eating sugar, they produce so much that they die off. They essentially kill themselves in the container. And so there's this natural limit, you know, 11, 12, something like that percent alcohol that's hard to get much higher than normally. And there's a number of sort of early distilling pioneers in Europe in medieval times, but the one I found most interesting and compelling that I mentioned in the book was a Catalan named Ramon Llull. I'll say Raymond Lull. That's the sort of anglicized version, which is a little easier to pronounce. But he, in 1260s, you know, long time ago, he was sort of a playboy and a drunk and liked to compose, you know, sort of naughty songs and rhymes. And he was just sort of a, you know, essentially sort of a derelict drunken playboy who came from a wealthy family at the time. But he had a religious conversion experience. He saw God and decided he was done with this life of sin and carnal excess. And he joined the Holy Orders of St. Francis, essentially became a Franciscan, became a monk, I guess you could say. And the funny thing was once he stopped fooling around so much and got serious, he turned out to be a genius. I mean, he was really brilliant. He wrote treatises on botany and philosophy. He's considered to be the father of computational math. But I think he never completely gave up his love of the odd drink now and then, because he started working with alcohol and he used some techniques that were very old, went back to Alexandria and had even been used by Arab scholars for hundreds of years. This distilling technique, but no one up to that point had ever used it with alcohol. And I think it took someone who liked their drink now and then to put two and two together. And he was among the very first Europeans, if not the first, to start distilling alcoholic drinks. And he first would have been using wine, because in the Mediterranean, you have lots of grapes, lots of wine. But as a monk, other monks learned about it. Ireland and Scotland are two countries where the monastic life was very important. There were lots of pilgrimages. They brought that technique back, and that's where whiskey comes from. Because essentially, in the north, grain grows much better than grapes, so they had beer, not wine. So they, you know, they would have loved to have distilled wine like they did in the Mediterranean. They couldn't. The climate just didn't produce that many grapes. But they did have lots of beer, and the same technique worked with beer. Instead of brandy coming out the other end, you get early whiskey, which would be clear and unaged at first, but, you know, barrel aging is what gives it that brown color.
Now, I'm surprised that he would have stopped his wayward ways, and all of a sudden he's like this genius. I would have figured all the drinking would have killed off the bad brain cells, and with the new ones, he should have been a genius when he was drinking.
Well, I'm not positive he ever stopped the drinking part. He mentions formulas for quote-unquote loosening the wine in his journals, which my impression was that he seemed pretty enthusiastic about it and liked it, so he must have enjoyed the sensation it gave him, so I doubt he ever gave it up completely.
Well, I guess after he did that, the monastery just grew like crazy. Well, too many people, they had to turn some away.
Well, yeah. Yeah, quite probably. And it was at that time, you know, the production of alcohol it became a very important part of monastic life. When you think of Trappist ales, how they brew beer, you know, a lot of these monks were cultivating wine or beer or making spirits. And at the time, too, in this day and age, you understand that something like whiskey might give you a momentary feeling of bliss or happiness, but in the long run, it can be, you know, relatively bad for you if you're not careful. But I think at the time, they really regarded it as a medicine. They were, you know, that's what they call the water of life, eau de vie, aquavit, whiskivea, which is Gaelic for water of life too, where whiskey comes from, the name. So they had this sense that there was something kind of sacred and precious, that there was an essence to it that would elevate your spirit and make you feel better.
I like to dabble in sometimes brewing beer. I like to dabble with perhaps making some hard cider. It's kind of difficult nowadays where they add preservatives, so you really have to go out and juice your own apples that way. You talked in your book Bourbon, your brand new book, Bourbon, History of the American Spirit, that rum at one point was the leading import here in the United States early on, made out of molasses. Did you ever do any research to find out how they make that?
Sure. Well, this is something that I found fascinating is, it doesn't seem like it today, but at one point, America really was a colony of rum drinkers. Before our revolution, we were getting just tons and tons of cheap rum and the molasses to make rum through the British, who had colonies in the Caribbean, and we were a convenient place to unload all that excess rum and molasses, and, you know, we would pay for it. And they were essentially our transatlantic enabler. They made it easy to keep drinking rum. And because of that, there weren't, you know, our own native spirits, things like cider and whiskey to the same extent. They didn't gain a foothold as easily because there's just so much cheap rum out there. And, you know, and rum at its essence, it's sugarcane mashed up. Molasses is mashed up sugarcane, and you have all that sugar. And just like with wine or beer, once you have that sugar, you can ferment it, and yeast can turn into alcohol, and you can distill it. So that's where rum comes from. And it wasn't, you know, we had all this cheap rum. Americans were drinking tons of it, far more than people do today. And what happened was when the revolution came around, suddenly that rum wasn't available. We were cut off from it. We were blockaded. The British weren't allowing imports, and we didn't want it from them anyway to buy their rum. And suddenly, even Benjamin Franklin mentions this in the Poor Richard Almanac, that we needed to figure out a way to make alcohol from our own native corn, our own grains. And that's exactly what happened. And you can see in that period from the late 1700s to the early 1800s, we really flip-flopped. We went from drinking mostly rum and a little bit of whiskey to drinking mostly whiskey and a little bit of rum once we had to become more self-sufficient as a country, as a people, and as alcohol makers and use our own grains.
Seems like that the molasses would almost be like the sugars, like you mentioned, to make the beer where you could ferment that. Is that drinkable before you distill it?
I would assume so. I mean, I've never heard, perhaps in the Caribbean or Latin America, they have something like that. I'm not familiar with it, but I would assume that that first stage of fermentation, you would have a very sweet drink that was, you know, that had that same level of alcohol as, you know, wine or something akin to that. And that's what you would distill. I'm honestly not sure if that is consumed or not. I would assume that it could be, though.
Yeah, because it sounds like the malt that you would put in, you know, to a beer that way. A history of the American spirit. We go way back, presidents and everybody. During Prohibition, I'm thinking that I remember even people that voted against having alcohol were going to these hidden places and taking part in the drinking.
Definitely. Bourbon played an important role in Prohibition. It helped fuel the jazz age, and a lot of these clubs that were jazz was popular. It was served and consumed, and much of jazz music came from the South. So many of the most celebrated jazz artists enjoyed their bourbon, and there's some accounts of that in the book. Literature, the Lost Generation drank plenty of bourbon. Hemingway loved it. F. Scott Fitzgerald, you think of him as a gin, sort of gin drinker, but he liked bourbon too, and he actually first started some of his problematic drinking in Louisville at the Selbach Hotel, where he allegedly was thrown out of at one point. I think that's true, but that's the story. So, you know, bourbon played an important role in that period in our history, and, you know, helped that transition. In my mind, that's sort of when we became a modern nation. I think that was our adolescence and coming of age was Prohibition, and bourbon was certainly part of it. But on the other hand, Prohibition shut down most of the big distilleries. The only ones that were allowed to stay open, the only way you could get bourbon really was through a medicinal permit. So you know, it was almost like the medicinal marijuana of its day. You could go to the doctor, get a prescription, go to the pharmacy and get a little flask of bourbon whiskey. But most of the distilleries had to shut down, and it was really hard on the industry. And it was very difficult immediately after the Great Depression. It was very difficult for a lot of these distilleries to get back on their feet, and even harder once they did to actually have the time and money to produce good bourbon, which requires aging and a little more careful treatment. So it was a big setback for our country, much like Prohibition was. I mean, it was a setback and a positive culturally, and I think you see the same thing with bourbon.
I think I know this answer, but, you know, you can brew beer up to so many hundreds of gallons of beer. You can make wine. Can you have a still at your house?
No, not without the proper licensing. It's either, you know, the old stories about the moonshiners and revenueers, and, you know, there's truth to that. I believe it's not legal without the proper permits to engage in home distilling.
Seems like it'd just be easier to go to the store.
Yes, I think it would. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is there's a potential that it could be dangerous, but it's also just taxation. The government collects a tremendous amount of taxes from spirits, and if you're making it without a license and they don't know about it, you know, they could potentially be missing out on quite a bit of money. So I think that's the other side of it.
I think they're finding that out with marijuana also, the way that some of the states are starting to embrace that.
Yeah, I suspect you'll see many of the same things. And, you know, in when it comes to taxing vices, whether it's tobacco or spirits or marijuana, I guess, potentially, there's always that double-edged sword and that people are a little uneasy about it. But at the same time, you get a tremendous influx of taxation money, which governments usually don't mind. So, and that was another I forgot to mention about prohibition, was the government was missing out on all that taxable income from spirits, which in some ways helped really, you know, triggered the Great Depression in a way, or at least kept them from responding well to it, because they'd missed out on all that capital for so long.
Dane, The History of the American Spirit Bourbon, your very first book, and it's a great read, actually. It is a page-turner. I like where you're talking about some of the presidents, some of our past founders, and the type of comedy also that you put in. You put in very descriptive words, which sometimes brings them to more of a laughable almost. It makes you smile when you're reading it, I should say. This, of course, your first book. What's next? Do you have another book?
I'm still working on that. I'm working on a novel at the moment, which hopefully will turn out okay and work out. I've also, as far as nonfiction goes, starting to think about possibly beer. That's one idea, because it goes well together. Bourbon and beer, I'd say, are two national beverages at a large level. So that's a possibility. Not 100% sure yet, but those are two things I'm working on.
With bourbon, you really couldn't put much of a recipe in there. Beer, maybe.
Oh, yeah, my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, he's a home brewer, even grows his own hops, which, with mixed results. I feel like the last time they didn't turn out as well as he'd hoped. But I think he would definitely be happy if there was some beer recipes, and even if I made a couple batches to become familiar with the process with them.
Dane, do you happen to have a website?
Yes, I do. It's www.danehucklebridge.com. That's DaneHucklebridge.com.
And when we go there, what will we see?
Well, a little bit about my background and what I've been doing, and a picture taken by a friend of mine as the background, so an author's photo.
Well, you know, you've probably had it sometime in your life, whiskey, bourbon. Check out A History of the American Spirit Bourbon by Dane Hucklebridge. I'm telling you, it's a page-turner, and it's just loaded with a lot of information. Dane, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Dane Hucklebridge, author of his new book, Bourbon, A History of the American Spirit. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.